Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, Election 2016 Political Roundtable, a week-to-week special hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and sponsored by the Applied Materials Foundation. First of all, I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting this important conversation. In less than 2 months, Santa Clara County voters will be asked to vote on 17 state ballot measures, including gun control, marijuana legalization, and the death penalty, as well as various local measures. We will also decide the next president of the United States, California senators, many more important offices. We face a very large ballot in a very important election. At Applied Materials, our innovations make possible the technology shaping the future. And one of Applied's key values is to make a positive contribution to our local communities. Since our founding 50 years ago in Silicon Valley, Applied has been committed to making community investments where our employees live. Applied and our foundation have provided funding to hundreds of agencies to support civic engagement, high-quality education, environmental stewardship, and arts and culture programs around the globe. And in alignment with the Foundation's interest in addressing local community needs and issues, it seemed only fitting to partner with the Commonwealth Club on tonight's event. We hope that each of us leaves this discussion better informed and perhaps more excited and prepared to cast a vote on Election Day. It's now my pleasure to introduce our panelists. Lonnie Chen is the David and Diane Steffi Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Larry Gersten is professor of political science at San Jose State University, a political analyst at NBC Bay Area, and author of Reviving Citizen Engagement and The Road to HANA. Barbara Marshman is the editorial page editor of the Mercury News. Moderating tonight's conversation is John Zipperer, vice president of media and editorial at the Commonwealth Club. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Lonnie Chen, Larry Gersten, Barbara Marshman, and John Zipperer.
Thank you, Joe. Well, welcome to Week to Week. It's the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club. We also think of it as your group therapy session for the 2016 election. This is Tuesday, September 13th, 2016. And we are very glad to be coming to you from here in Santa Clara, in the heart of Silicon Valley. I'm sure you've all been keeping up on your political news, or else you wouldn't be at a political roundtable. Yesterday, comedian Samantha Bee finally returned to her TBS program, and she was topical as ever, announcing, quote, "Let's get right to the big news. Hillary Clinton has passed away." She says she's not dead, but we know she's a liar. Well, thanks for joining us here today. I'm, as Joe mentioned, I'm John Zipperer, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we are going to talk about the presidential election. We could not. I should say we could not. I don't know. Can't avoid it. There's also a raft of propositions and ballot measures, as Joe said, I think 7,000 of them. So we're going to go through each and every one of them. This will be the first seven-hour week-to-week program. We'll have bathroom breaks and such, don't worry. We're also going to talk about some other things in the news, Colin Kaepernick and the national anthem and issues of racial justice that he's brought up, as well as other political news. And we will end with our news quiz, which will be your chance to win some chocolate. So I always like to note that at the Commonwealth Club, we're a place with people with a wide range of views. We welcome everybody. However, any opinions that are expressed up here tonight are those of the speakers and, of course, not of the Commonwealth Club. And finally, I want to express my thanks to the Applied Materials Foundation for their generous support for tonight's program and our social hour. So there are, we mentioned there are question cards around. Please send in as many questions as you can. I will submit my own, but some of the best will come from you, I know. So let's get right to it, and let's start with the presidential election. We're now past Labor Day. Early voting starts soon in some places. And as Larry has mentioned, what is it, like 60% of Californians will vote before Election Day? So give us a sense of where we are right now. And let's start with you, Lonnie. Where are we in this campaign? Is it kind of are we all just kind of waiting for the debate? Or, yeah. I mean, give us some sense of what we are.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the fourth. I'm actually not a current part of the presidential campaign. Those of you who've heard my commentary know that I'm not exactly a fan of Donald Trump, even though I am a Republican. This was the fourth presidential campaign I'd been a part of. I helped Marco Rubio in the primary and served as Governor Romney's chief policy advisor in 2012. And the reality of presidential campaigns is this: very little breaks through in a presidential campaign. So those of you who watch, you know, MSNBC or Fox or CNN every day and follow the twists and turns of the campaign closely, you're in the minority. Most Americans really don't tune in probably until the first debate. And the debate is really critical because it's people's opportunity to see the two candidates face-to-face for the first time and to hear them in their own words. And I think what makes debates particularly powerful is that they are very powerful, I think, potentially when they break down impressions people have of candidates, pre-existing impressions they have of candidates. So where I would say we are now is I think we're at a place where Hillary Clinton has certain intrinsic advantages from where she sits right now. And the Electoral College system, I think, is of great benefit to her. On the other hand, I think Donald Trump continues to be a lot closer than people would have expected or hoped or anticipated. And I think that's a function of a few different things. One is the fact that it is very difficult to underestimate the amount of disaffection in the American electorate. I think there's a lot of frustration. I think the economic stagnation that hasn't quite affected Silicon Valley has affected the rest of the country in a very real way.
And both parties.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And it's not a political statement. It's true. There's a lot of economic anxiety out there. You have, until today, in fact, wages were essentially stagnant. They've been essentially stagnant for some time now. Mm-hmm. The economic opportunities that do exist, people generally feel like they're overqualified for the openings that exist. So people are underemployed or they're employed in part-time work and would really like to be in the full-time labor market. So for all sorts of different reasons, there's a lot of anxiety out there. So couple the anxiety with the fact that Donald Trump is a television star. I mean, that's really what he is, right? If it really comes down to it, he can say he's a businessman. Really, he's a TV personality. And I think that has made him very effective in communicating whatever message it is he's communicating. And the last thing I'll say is I do think Hillary Clinton is a historically weak candidate for the Democrats. I think that they could have nominated pretty much anyone else, and they would be doing quite well against Trump as opposed to her. I think it's not entirely her fault. I think she's very thoughtful, and she's got a deep career in public service. I think her problem is that people don't trust her. And the most recent episode around her health has only, I think, animated that distrust people have of her. So I often say if the Republicans had nominated anybody else, he or she would be winning in a walk. If the Democrats had nominated anybody else, he or she would be winning in a walk. But instead, we have two very flawed candidates in a cycle that people just want to be over.
So both of them are lucky to be facing the other one.
Yeah. So I think Barbara? We can all leave now.
Yeah. Go home and wake up on November 9th.
You know, I think the despite the almost frightening superheated economy here, that dissatisfaction, that you know, gap exists mm-hmm. very much here in Silicon Valley. And although mm-hmm. Wages are closing now nationally, and I haven't looked at those numbers for the Valley yet, we still have our housing problem. But I think there is widespread dissatisfaction, and I thought I knew what was happening with this campaign, but I don't anymore. I will say, funny letter to the editor in tomorrow morning's paper that basically says, Hillary Clinton just did what women do. She got sick. She ignored her doctor's advice. She forged on. Just do her work. Take care of the kids. Take care of the job. And that's what you... Yeah, sorry. Apologies to the guys here. But... You know, everything that happens, and as usual with Hillary Clinton, and I'm, I could not vote for Donald Trump, even if I were a Republican, and I'm not. But, I mean, Hillary Clinton is her own worst enemy, right down to this. I mean, if the campaign had said on Friday, she has pneumonia, and then she showed up for a while at 9/11, she'd have been a hero. But instead, she kept it all in, and she tries to do with everything. And here we are.
Larry, what do you think?
I think there are a couple of things to think about that make this election closer than it might have been. Number one, the press for the longest time didn't really know how to handle Donald Trump. They treated him, first of all, as a joke, you know, a caricature. Let's fill in time with this guy who thinks he's going to be president, imagine. And with that, you know, they gave him a pass on almost everything. Whatever the outrageous comment he made, well, that's Donald Trump, that's the celebrity apprentice guy, that's, you know, this and that, bigger than life. He doesn't really want to be president. He's going to drop out of this race in a month or two or three. And so for probably 6 or 8 months, this guy built up a head of steam that others would have been challenged on, and he wasn't. And almost everyone bears responsibility for that. Okay, that's the first thing I would say. The second thing is, you're quite right. Congress is likely the House to be Republican because of the massive gerrymandering that benefits Republican members of the House. 40% are automatically going to win no matter what. They can die and they'd win. I'll leave it at that. The Electoral College does benefit the Democrats. That said, we're in an interesting period. If you look back at history the last 50, 60 years, every time a party has been in the presidency for two terms, be it Democrat, be it Republican, the next time around, the other party wins. And why is that? Americans don't want to do too much of the same thing for too long. That's bipartisan. It doesn't matter who's been in power. You know, whether it's Clinton yielding to Bush, whatever it might have been. The one exception was when H.W. Bush defeated Clinton. Defeated Dukakis in 1988 and served one term.
Yeah.
And served one term. So the power of being anti-incumbent is something that Hillary Clinton or any Democrat would have to deal with this time around. And so those little factors, I think, which some might consider to be on the periphery, I think they weigh much larger this time around, perhaps because of the candidates being weak, but they weigh much larger than we might have expected.
Isn't it interesting, though, that Barack Obama is more popular now than he's been in years? You know, that he's...
Well, people look at the alternatives.
Yeah. But that's unusual for the sitting president to be able to actually go out and campaign, because usually they're keeping their heads down.
I watched his speech today. I wasn't intending to watch his speech. I was about to leave, and I just was stuck. Yeah. You know, I'm mesmerized, as I often am with great speakers, and he is that.
Yeah.
And I kept waiting for the crowd to burst out with one more term.
Yeah.
You know, it was amazing.
I don't know if you saw the Facebook meme someone was passing around about, you know, the Republicans attacking Hillary Clinton on this whole pneumonia matter, and it said it was the first time Republicans have worried about women's health. sorry, Republicans. But do you think that if it weren't for that, there would be something else? I mean, she's gone through the whole email issue. She's gone through the Clinton Foundation issue. Had her campaign come out and said on Friday she's got pneumonia, you know, you would have had Rudy Giuliani out there saying, "Yep, see, she's frail." Yeah. I mean, it's
all of these self-inflicted wounds, right? I mean, they're not running a particularly good campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that she's an underperforming candidate with an underperforming campaign. I mean, that's really the problem, I think, right now. I think again, it's not the fact of the emails or the fact of the Clinton Foundation or the fact of whatever health issue she might be dealing with. It's the manner in which those items have been dealt with.
They've reacted
to. Yeah, I mean, and I think that that's part of the problem. So, you know, the Clinton campaign generally likes to return to the narrative that there's a vast right-wing conspiracy. conspiracy. And at some point, what they have to do is take a good look in the mirror and say, what can we do as a campaign to get out in front of this? Yeah. So I actually thought they dealt with Basket of Deplorables quite well, this comment that she made regarding half of the Trump supporters. I thought that they dealt with that very well. I thought that she got out in front of it and allowed it to be less of a problem than it could have been for their campaign. Contrast that with the health and the foundation and the emails, all of which have been handled pretty disastrously by that campaign, I think.
Can I add one thing?
Larry?
The Clintons, and I, nonpartisan here, the Clintons suffer from a disease, and the disease is entitlement. And whether it's Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton, and I cannot tell you why, I don't know what's in their water, whatever it is, they sort of feel like we can do it our way. And you know, people will understand or they won't. And if they don't, it's too bad. And the deal with the emails is a classic case. I mean, you know, it really wasn't such a terrible thing. It really wasn't. But if in fact someone's going to, you know, point the finger at you and say, you really shouldn't have done this way because, and if there's some argument to that effect that makes sense, you say, gosh,
yeah,
you know, that was a mistake. Now, she walks around now saying, well, I said it was a mistake. Yeah, 14 years later. Okay? I mean, that doesn't do any good anymore. And that's the kind of thing that leads people to distrust her and Bill Clinton, too. The sad thing is, she's probably the smartest, most qualified person to run for that office in memory. She's brilliant. She's a policy wonk, and that bores a lot of people. I get excited about it, you know, and tells you what we do at my house at night. But I mean, you know, she is really one smart cookie. But as you said, she and he spend some time shooting themselves in the foot.
Let's talk about Trump's problems, and he's been going
through. How long do we have?
7 hours. We've expanded it, remember?
Right, we said that already.
And I want to talk about it's called the Russian connection, you know, his bromance with Vladimir Putin, you know, the whole Paul Manafort connection with, you know, Ukrainian, Russian money, et cetera. I mean, Lonnie, is certainly, you know, a number of Republicans have parted ways with Trump specifically because of foreign policy. They do not trust him. You know, to have the proverbial finger on the button. But then again, presidential elections, at least the general line is, it's the economy, stupid. They're not won or lost on foreign policy. What role do you think, you know, the Russia thing and foreign policy in general will play in the election?
Well, yeah, so I think you're right that in general, the most important factor that drives vote choice is the economy and one's view of how someone will handle the economy. I think in this situation, there's a couple of factors at play. One is it isn't so much about foreign policy as it is about temperament, judgment, and preparedness for the office. Okay, so I think when voters say that they care about foreign policy in this election, what they're actually saying is, we care about the temperament of the person or their level of preparedness. The thing that's troubling about, I mean, there's many things that are troubling about the thing with Putin and Trump. What is most troubling is the misapprehension of the way in which Putin has stood opposed to U.S. interests pretty much at every turn for the last 7 or 8 years. I think the Obama administration vastly underestimated Putin at the outset. I think that they embarked on a foolish set of policies with respect to engagement with Russia. And then when they finally did come around to the reality of who he was, you know, by then, you know, it was probably too late. And so I think for now, Trump to be engaging in this strange fixation on Trump, on Putin, it just suggests to me that there's just a lack of preparedness there. And you know, the temperament stuff is a different issue, right? The temperament stuff is how he flies off the handle about everything.
Right.
But the Putin thing, in my mind, is a question of preparedness and judgment.
So if I'm Hillary Clinton, which I'm not, if I were, I'm sitting there preparing for the first debate, and because, you know, she's already started. She's nothing if not prepared. What? Start with you, Barbara. What do you think she will do? Do you think she will try to get Trump to highlight, you know, those moments of his temperament, or do you think she'll play the policy wonk and just let the contrast show? I mean, what do you think?
I would, a couple of weeks ago, I would have said she would try to go at him. I mean, right now, I think with this health thing looming, the main thing she has to appear is strong and steady.
Well, wait, she has pneumonia. She should go up to him and hug him and kiss him.
That's true. No. It's not contagious. Oh, okay. Because she was accused of giving it to her grandchildren.
Yeah. But the antibiotics kicked in after 24 hours.
The antibiotics kicked in time, apparently.
I stand corrected.
So I really don't. I am very worried about it, actually, because I'm afraid of Donald Trump. I would not have been afraid of Marco Rubio. I'm afraid of Donald Trump. The finger on the button thing. I wish someone could come up with the Goldwater ad. I mean, Goldwater, in retrospect, is a perfectly moderate person, but the nuclear explosion that did in poor Barry Goldwater. I'm not sure. Larry, you may have a better sense of, you know, how...
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, she has to wait to see which Donald Trump shows up.
Right.
No, I don't mean that in a flippant way. Yeah. I really don't. Is this going to be the Donald Trump who really takes no prisoners and who is abusive and who doesn't care a whit about insulting somebody no matter what? And saying things that are in one line form and going on real quick, or is it going to be the Donald Trump who attempts to be presidential? I've given this a lot of thought. This is a big picture. This is the story. This is why. If it's the first, she has to make sure that he self-destructs. Don't step in. Right. Let him make his own mistakes. If it's the second, she has to make sure that she's not patronizing. Because that can come out real easily. No, you don't get it. You know, let me tell you how it really works. She can't do that. So in a way, in football, you know, you want to, if you're playing defense, you want to see what the offense is throwing at you before you decide how you're going to manage it. I kind of think that at least early on, the first few minutes, she has to be wait and see which way, and she has to prepare for both.
And he did show in Mexico when he was on the podium with the president a fairly presidential demeanor. Now, the minute he got on the plane, the president said he was a liar, and then Trump went to Phoenix and doubled down on anti-Mexican. But for those moments, he sounded presidential.
Yeah, but that was a different environment.
Oh, it was.
You know, he controlled that entire environment by what he said, right? When you're on that stage and you've got 90 seconds, okay, you don't have the luxury of controlling exactly what goes on more than those 90 seconds. And that's why those 90 seconds for him, the first couple of times, are critical. Which way is he going to go? How prepared is he? He says he hasn't paid any attention. One of the interesting things about Donald Trump is that it appears, to the outsider at least, that he doesn't spend a lot of time looking at these issues and that he responds from his gut. Mm-hmm. You know, what can I say? What will they tolerate? What will they take? What will they like? Well, if that's the case, that'll be the first Donald Trump. If it's the second Donald Trump, where he's really going to try to be like in Mexico, that'll be different for her.
You know, debates are a lot about expectations. Mm-hmm. So you notice this cat and mouse game where campaigns always try to set expectations and talk about how wonderful of a debater the opponent is. And I mean, in this situation, I think one has to be very careful to not underestimate Donald Trump. He is very effective on television. And he knows better than anybody else that this debate format that he's about to go into is very different from the primary debate. You know, he did, 15 primary debates. I've probably been in hundreds of debate prep meetings with candidates, and I can tell you that the biggest mistake people make is to assume that every debate is created equal, and it's not. The general election debate is really a very different animal because it requires you to engage at a level and proficiency of policy that you don't have to do in the primary. In the primary, you can get away with clever one-liners and you can do your shtick. At some point, you're just going to run out of BS to spew, and you're going to have to come back to answering the question. And I think particularly, you remember the debates also have, as I understand it, subject matter focuses as well. So, you know, in 2012, our first debate was focused on domestic and economic policy. You're going to have a 90-minute discussion on domestic and economic policy. And then you're going to have another 90-minute discussion on foreign policy and then a 90-minute grab bag for the last debate. It's very, very difficult to prepare somebody to just go in there and shoot from the hip for 90 minutes. It's hard, particularly when you're debating somebody who kind of, you know, probably has answers that sound reasonable.
Except Trump has said over and over again, I need to be me. I need to be me. And every time they try to get him to stand in front of that teleprompter, of course, it's not the same situation. You know, he's very robotic. He loses the crowd, right? And the crowd is his inspiration. The crowd is his shot. And I'm not so sure that he or his, well, I'm sure his people have figured it out, but I'm not so sure that Trump realizes that this is going to be a different environment, that he can't go ahead and just shoot the one line.
That maybe.
I'm going to be America great again. I don't have to worry about all these things. Elect me and I'll show you how we're going to do it.
That may be, although I think that the last couple weeks he's managed to be much more sort of conventional than he has at any other point in this campaign, which suggests he's capable of doing it. And by the way, I actually think he has real advisors around him now. You know, I think Kellyanne Conway is very good. You know, and I think the rest of the team he's put in there, you know, I don't know Steve Bannon, but I also don't know what role he's playing on the campaign. My sense is that he's actually got some real advisors around him now.
Before we move on to our next topic, briefly, there are third-party candidates. The two major ones are Libertarian Gary Johnson and Green Party Jill Stein. Are they playing much of a role? There was, for a while, Gary Johnson seemed to be, you know, heading toward that 15% that would have allowed him to be a part of the debates. He seems to have faded a bit, unless I'm foreseeing stuff. I'm not. What do you think, Larry?
Two things. Johnson may have the best shot in Utah. Mitt Romney's been so vocal, and the largely Mormon community there does not appreciate Donald Trump at all. They don't really like Hillary Clinton, so you could see him, you know, get, you know, some large number of votes, 25%, 30%, 35% there. Not enough to win, but enough to throw it. And I think that may be the case in a couple of other states. I don't think he makes a big difference, but in a couple of other states, you know, he may siphon off enough votes, you know, to allow one of the other two candidates to win. Jill Stein is not making much of an impact at all. She's at 2%. Johnson's about 10%. Now we're back to the debates. Everything can change after that debate.
Yeah.
Everything can change after that. And the first debate, of course, is so critical. So, but absent some sort of dramatic change, neither one appears to be breaking into that 15%.
You know, to the point about sort of in the day-to-day flow of the campaign, very, very little impacting the campaign, I do think that Gary Johnson's inability to know what Aleppo was is pretty damaged. I mean, that's tough. I mean, and, you know, part of it is maybe you could say, well, it's admirable that he didn't do the typical politician and say, well, it depends on what you mean by Aleppo.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really complicated issue. We'll have to look into that. I mean, it was just like deer in the headlights, what Aleppo, what? You know, it's like he looked like a disaster. Yeah. And I think that's one of those moments where people look at somebody and they just say, as much as I dislike Trump and I dislike Clinton, I can't vote for this guy.
Now, and wasn't that, sorry to step on you, Barbara, wasn't that kind of the hope for at least a fair number of the never Trump Republicans that at least if they went out to vote for Gary Johnson, they would get out and then vote, you know, Republicans and conservatives would still vote for down ballot Republicans, even if they didn't vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah, see, but I was never convinced by the thesis that that those Republicans who oppose Trump would go vote for Gary Johnson, because the proportion of the social conservative Republicans were not going to be able to tolerate Gary Johnson on marijuana and prostitution. And then the portion of national security conservatives who were more hawkish would not tolerate him on foreign policy. So who was he really left with? I mean, he was left with some economic conservatives maybe, but those economic conservatives by and large have all come home to Trump. That's the reality of where the race has gone in the last couple of weeks. Trump has consolidated Republican support. That explains why he's doing better in the polling. He's not winning independents. He's consolidating his base.
Good point.
Yeah.
Barbara, any thoughts on the third-party candidates?
Just that it's a real dilemma. You know, so many people say, well, why can't somebody like Johnson participate in the base? But you just have to have that threshold or everybody right. gets in. It is a frustrating democratic phenomenon, lowercase democratic phenomenon that there's no way to break in.
It's a good thing you said that, because a question from the audience, isn't Trump, with his scary chances of success, the best proof that democracy doesn't work? This is our dystopian audience here tonight. Well, let's dig into some statewide and some local ballot measures. For those folks who are listening to this or watching it online from other states, you get to laugh at us, because in California, we vote on everything. And I was joking that there were 7,000 ballots or things on the ballot, but actually, as Joe mentioned, there are 17 at least. And depending on where you live, you might have a number of additional local ones. Let's start off with some of the statewide ones. There's a proposition, of course, what's called the Gavin Newsom, Gary Johnson proposition to legalize marijuana. Is it going to pass this time, Barbara? What do you think?
I think it may. It's always been teetering. I mean, I think you have Colorado out there and other states that are having problems, but the momentum, just as with medical marijuana, I think the momentum goes that way. And let's face it, what we are doing now isn't working. Our editorial board has never supported one of these before, but we've said, you know, let's go in and see if we can make this work. Not that that means voters are going to do it, but there is a sense that it's becoming more the norm.
Yeah, I mean, there is a progressive, and I don't mean that in a political context, there's a progressive process through which initiatives eventually pass, right? Usually it may take a few times. The electorate has to be in a place where they're willing to accept it. And I think in California, with medical marijuana, with the Obama administration's decision to not actively pursue prosecution on a lot of marijuana possession-related crimes, you know, I just think the writing's on the wall on this one, which, you know, personally I find distasteful, but it is, I mean, I think the electorate is where they are.
Yeah. Larry?
A number of cities and counties, of course, have already passed legislation regarding medical marijuana, but what I found on the ballot this time is a number of cities and counties have measures that would tax marijuana
right.
between 10% and 15%, the assumption being that it passes.
Yeah.
There have been two studies out. One independent study suggests that there'll be a gain of the state for the state of $1.3 billion in taxes at least, the other being $1.6. If people don't feel too harmed by what they've already seen, you know, with the medical marijuana that's being so present everywhere. Yeah, it's the kind of thing where it could pass. It could pass. It wouldn't surprise me.
Yep. Go ahead.
There are folks in Colorado who are saying that the windfall that was expected, the dollars are there, but the costs are also a lot higher, and that it...
It's just hard to collect, too, right?
Because
the problem is that there are still federal laws that govern the transmission of the money. So to collect the money and then be able to remit a tax requires the cooperation of banking authorities, but banking authorities are hamstrung by federal law. So there's all this federal junk in the way of this really working out to be the windfall that people think. And I think maybe in a few years it'll be, but for now, that would not be, if I were a proponent of the measure, I would not be going to that well.
Yeah.
Now, that's one of the better known ballot measures, I think, on the statewide ballot. Larry, and I think you said this at one of our previous Week to Weeks, and that is when there are ballot measures, especially a lot of them, and people don't necessarily know about them, they're more likely to vote just no on it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. mostly because they're overwhelmed. I mean, what is it? The statewide voter analysis booklet is booklet book, 245 pages of the smallest print you'll ever want to see. Okay? You better have a magnifying glass when you read it. And so, you know, people get down these silly arguments. Whether they're the summary by the attorney general or the 30-second commercials, if they're confused, and there's a number of them this time, they will vote no. Only one-third pass. Only one-third ever get through. So the odds already are against it. And this time, of course, you've got two canceling each other on capital punishment.
Talk a bit about that.
Right? 62 and 66, I think it is. Right. 62 says, forget capital punishment because it's so costly to keep these people on death row, $1 million a year per person. Let's just throw away the key and make it life imprisonment without parole. The other one says, oh, no, you got it wrong. Let's speed up the process, you know. You go to San Quentin and get in line and let's get it done. So if they both pass, and that's happened before in California, if they both pass, the one with the most amount of votes will win. But instead, it could be that both will be defeated for that very reason.
And then we're back to status quo.
Status quo.
So given that I assume, again, we've got folks here who, like us, read about the stuff and talk about the stuff, but most voters aren't going to make it through that 200 and whatever page dictionary. So which ones do you think will pass voter muster amongst that group of them? Lonnie, I mean, what would you expect to, of the statewide ones, what do you expect will get approved?
Yeah, so now I have to remember what they all are. I do think that the marijuana one and the legalization of marijuana ends up passing. I think that the school bond will get pretty close, if not all the way there.
Now, is this the one that's basically extending Prop 30?
Well, 51.
51.
This is where everyone in other states are laughing their heads off.
And it's crazy. 51 is the one that allows construction bonds to move forward with less oversight than before. And Jerry Brown's dead set against this one because he believes that it will be loosey-goosey and benefit mostly the builders and nobody else. So 55 is the one that extends Prop 30.
Right.
Okay.
That one has virtually no opposition and has already collected, I think, $43 million. So that one, I think, people feel, look, who are you talking about? You're talking about the fat cats in California. You're talking about the 1%. 1%, by the way, who pays 70% of the state income taxes. So we'll stick it to them. They've already been stuck for the last 4 years. They'll be stuck for a little longer. It's okay. They won't even know. So I think that's got a very good bet. But there's some other juicy ones.
Like what?
Well, the one with pharmaceuticals that has the potential of lowering pharmaceutical costs, and that's Prop 61. The pharmaceutical industry has already spent $90 million. They haven't started yet, okay? They're just warming up. $90 million to oppose that. So there are a few of those. Of course, the tobacco tax, 56. That's another one where the tobacco industry has already spent $44 million. Mm-hmm. Wow. We'll probably spend somewhere around 80 or 100 million. That one just missed winning, to your point, 4 years ago. Just missed. I think it'll pass this time.
Yeah.
Barbara, what are you guys most watching?
On the way over, I happened to hear an anti-tobacco tax ad in the voice of a mom saying, this does nothing for your children. It's stealing money from school. I mean, it was just insane. But that'll be a tough fight. The school bond, I just want to mention, it's sort of a pet peeve of mine. What it does is extend the current system for school bonds, matching funds. And the reason Brown is most against it is the current system, first of all, is first come, first serve for school districts. It is in no way targeted at the most needy districts, which, and the other thing is, the law is that as long as there is state bond money available, developers cannot be charged for more than, I think it's half of the impacts of new schools. So it's essentially having the state pay for, you know, lots of kids moving into the Santa Clara School District. It will pass, I think, just because people check on school bonds. But that's one of those things that's really insidious about California measures.
And Barbara, the title of that one is what's going to assure its passage.
Yeah.
The title. No one needs to read. Yep. Californians are pretty good about this. Mm-hmm. Supporting schools, whether it's bonds, parcel taxes, almost pass. They almost always pass. And they know how to manage it now. The districts have got it down just right. And I think it'll pass because of the title.
Wait. What is the title of it?
I don't remember, but it's got school.
School construction. So the prescription drug one is really interesting because that will be a test of the sort of the national, how much the national environment affects what's happening in California. Because healthcare is one of those issues. People are sick of talking about healthcare because of all the debate around the Affordable Care Act. But the one issue in healthcare that continues to spike, if you look at public opinion testing, is the question of prescription drug pricing. Of course, the thing about the California measure is it was written in such a ham-handed manner, and it affects so few people at the end of the day that it really will be a test of whether, in fact, the issue is that people are just they just want to stick it to the pharmaceutical companies versus if they actually dig into it. My guess is that they reject 61 this time and something else comes around 2 years from now that might be crafted a little more carefully that might pass or in 2020. But for now, I have a tough time. I mean, this thing is really poorly drafted and will not actually accomplish, I think, a lot of the goals that its proponents want.
No, a lot of AIDS organizations, for example, are very much against it because they feel it will make certain kinds of medication just
harder to get,
unavailable. Yeah.
Well, let's move to the local scene, and there's a blizzard of them, but there are also a lot of them that are kind of around similar topics. And one we were talking before the program about is a number of them on raising public money for transportation. In Santa Clara, I believe they'll be voting on Measure B, which is, I think, to raise $6 or $6.5 billion. Yeah, a sales tax for local transportation projects. There's Measure C for funding AC Transit. Contra Costa County will be voting on Measure X, which I just think is a cool name. it's more money for this. There's a vote for bond for BART, everyone's favorite transportation agency. So let's talk a bit about why are we seeing so many measures going? Why do they have to go to voters? Is this something in order to raise money for these things they have to? And this seems to be more than we see normally. Is it because of the state of things, or are we in a cycle? Why, someone tell us what's going on.
This is because of the inability of the federal government to move on infrastructure of any kind. And I think that has trickled down. The idea, though, of raising the sales tax to help pay for transportation, I think, is particularly problematic because sales taxes are highly regressive. They end up hurting the people who, you know, could probably benefit from those improvements the most. And so that structure, in my mind, is a little problematic from a policy perspective. I think it probably ends up passing. But, raising sales taxes is a very dangerous thing, I think.
It is, but it seems to be the way these have always been done. And I think business gets behind it a little more because, it is going to the lower end. But you need these things. It's interesting. Actually, Scott Herhold, our paper, mentioned in a column the other day that, a lot of us feel like, we have brought BART to Berryessa, which is the sort of suburban neighborhood in San Jose. I mean, it's urbanizing now, but it's not downtown. And I just feel like, okay, we've got it this far. We've got to bring it downtown or we're really toast. I mean, there's no place to even turn around the trains in Berryessa. But they're selling it on potholes and on fixing the county expressways, which are a complete disaster, haven't had work in years. It's just a backlog. It's a backlog everywhere. LA is doing it, but there's just nothing. Combination of the federal government abdicating that role and the recession that just left no money available for anybody to do anything.
Larry?
I'll build on your point. You're absolutely right. Federal government, Congress has been stuck. They haven't done what they need to do regarding infrastructure, including transportation. The bills that they passed are basically status quo bills. No additional maintenance doesn't even get done. But let's go one step beyond that. The state of California's done the same thing.
Yep.
The state of California, Brown called a special session this year, They went into a special session. They came out with nothing. They said, we'll come back and meet later. They spent virtually months trying to work out with them. Jim Bell was taking the lead on that.
A hero, yeah.
Right. And the state of California desperately needs to raise gasoline taxes, which have been stuck at 18 cents since 1992.
Most even people are using less gasoline.
Yeah, we're using less gasoline with more cars.
Right.
Duh. Yeah. You know, does it take Einstein to figure this out?
Now, is there a separate federal gasoline tax?
There's a federal gasoline tax.
And then there's also a state.
There's a state gasoline tax. That's correct. And it's been stuck. It's crazy. And so, by default, it falls to the local governments. And it may not be the best way to do it. Sometimes you make bad choices because they're the best you can make.
Yep.
Right? So $14 billion are on the ballot this time in four counties. $14 billion in transportation changes. And my guess is I think they all pass.
Someone from the audience on Measure B, the Santa Clara transportation funding one, just notes that all residents share the roads. Doesn't it make sense that we all pay our fair share? So as opposed to kind of worrying about the lower income folks. Yeah. There are also a number of housing-related measures out there, S, T, V, and W. Don't ask me to delineate each and every detail of them, but is housing, and I'm in San Francisco where, you know, every good housing policy goes to die. So are referendums and measures the way to handle housing? When it's at the crisis level it is now, we haven't produced enough. We've got a booming population, a booming economy. It's exacerbating those issues of, you know, economic feelings of inequality that we were talking about earlier. So there's the idea of going to voters and trying to get them to either freeze things the way they are, as one of the measures is, or to, you know, incentivize certain things. Another approach was Governor Jerry Brown's recent attempt to, this is a gross generalization, but to fast-track development of multifamily housing that included certain percentages of affordable housing within it. What do you think about taking this to the ballot? Is this going to give us anything better? Larry?
Santa Clara County is a good example. $850 million, I believe it is.
$950, excuse me,
going to take a two-thirds vote. For that type of bond, it's not just a typical bond. It takes a two-thirds vote. I think it's going to be very difficult to pass. Simply because, here's what happens. There are so many tax issues on the ballot this time around. Voters are going to pick and choose. And right or wrong, guess who's going to be left for last?
It is also, it's framed as a bond to end homelessness, basically. And that is what polled highest when they did polling on housing. I know that some business groups don't want to support it because there's not enough of a sort of workforce housing component. But the polling. Here's the fundamental thing that happened here in Santa Clara County, at least. We used to have redevelopment agencies. And redevelopment agencies in San Jose, which is half the population of this county, Santa Clara made very good use of it too. San Jose didn't make good use of redevelopment overall, but it did make good use of the 20% housing set aside. And often it was up to 25, 30, I think sometimes even 35% of the money went into affordable housing, low, moderate, subsidized housing. And we had this stream. And through recessions, back when there was redevelopment, the only housing that continued to be built was affordable housing because it was through the redevelopment agencies and you could keep the financing going. Sure. Well, that's gone. Mm. And what we're seeing now is almost no production of that housing in an area where the rich or those of us who've owned our homes for 20-some years, can afford housing, and even, middle-income people have trouble renting an apartment. Is that fair, Lara? You've been here as long as longer than I have.
That's scary.
Yeah.
I remember the orchards.
Yeah. There were a few left when I got here.
Actually, I do. That's the sad part.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the redevelopment agencies did a lot of good things. Of course, what they did was strip away money that would have gone for education. Mm-hmm. And so when Jerry Brown became governor, he said, we can't afford that kind of thing anymore. And so it was controversial when he and the legislature got rid of them. It's controversial to this day. But back to the point, I just think as people see, you know, the massive number, you know, of various tax items, parcel taxes, school taxes, sales taxes, some of them are not going to make the cut.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the first one.
And I think the two big ones in Santa Clara County are the transportation tax and then the housing. And if they're going to vote one in Santa Clara County, I think they go transportation.
Well, very good. We're going to move on to other topics. I suggest if you want to learn more about these propositions, you certainly can go online to the Mercury News, Ballotpedia, find that giant book of tiny type and bottle of wine and work your way through it. Got some good questions from the audience. Before I get to that, I just wanted to talk briefly, get your opinions on Colin Kaepernick and the whole not standing for the national anthem and the statement he was trying to make. This is, of course, spread now to other teams. What do you think about this? Was it a good thing, a bad thing? I mean, he's gotten both support and criticism. Barbara?
I think it's turned into a good thing. When it first happened, our reaction was, you know, when did Colin Kaepernick develop public, you know,
any public sympathy? Sensibility,
I mean, he
right?
was he's not a very social person, and nobody was aware of. But he has since started talking about it, and I think it's interesting that the 49ers have kind of rallied behind him, and other teams are starting to do things. I think it's an interesting movement now. I mean, I've always, you know, the Speed City guys at San Jose State have always been my hero, using that public forum not to incite violence or anything, but to say, you know, okay, you're honoring me here. There's something you ought to know about. He may actually get it, you know, and he may actually be. I wish you were playing better football, but.
He played well last night.
He did play well last night. That was amazing.
Well. Lonnie, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was disrespectful, but look, I mean, he's an American citizen, as far as I know. He has a right to express his point of view, and you know, I would never say that he shouldn't be allowed to express his point of view the way he wants to. It's not how I would choose to do it. I think that the issues that he's speaking to deserve to be discussed, but I also just loathe the way that he approached it.
Larry, what are your thoughts?
65% of the NFL is black. Now basketball is over 90%. Baseball is 8%. Nonetheless, 65%. And I think he was trying to make a statement. I think he was sincere. Somebody said, well, gosh, why there? Why doesn't he do it at a, you know, McDonald's or someplace? Well, nobody's going to listen to him at a McDonald's. But when you've got a national audience of several million and a house of 70,000, yeah, you're going to get the spotlight. Yeah. I don't know if I would have done what he did. I don't know if I would have been so courageous to do what he did. But I think the guy is speaking his heart. And we it may be uncomfortable for a lot of us, you know, to see and hear these things, but we're not in his shoes.
For those of us who grew up in the Vietnam era, saw a lot more disrespectful things than sitting at the national anthem, and so it doesn't affect me the way it might younger folks.
And to your point, you know, John Carlos and Tommy Smith did what appeared to be terrible things at the Olympics, and now there's those great big statues, right? Yeah. And Muhammad Ali, you remember, refused to serve, and he died a hero. So sometimes, you know, people wind up saying things at places where we don't expect them to say it. But if, you know, if there's something behind it, I think it's worth discussing. If
and
nothing
else, looking for the something behind it, I thought was going to be the challenge here, and it may not be that bad.
Okay. Someone in the audience says they would love to hear the panel's views on the California Senate battle between two Democratic women. Who's going to win, Kamala or Ms. Sanchez?
I wish it were more of a contest. I don't think it is one. I mean, I think that Harris has done a pretty effective job at boxing. I mean, I think that Sanchez's play was to try and figure out if she could assemble a coalition that included maybe some center-right folks. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of center-right folks are thinking, why would I? I mean, I just vote for neither of them, you know. So yeah. I think she's running into a little bit of a constituency problem. So I don't see it as much of a contest. I haven't seen polling on it recently, but I don't imagine that it's close.
It wasn't the last time I looked. I haven't seen anything recent. It's, you know, Loretta's she's just a wild card is the thing. And she's from Orange County, and she does have some conservative support from the Central Valley, the water folks and everything, which I'm disappointed in Kamala Harris. I don't think she's set the world on fire as Attorney General. I think she's winning by being cautious. Mm-hmm. In our last conversation with her, I didn't have a sense that she understood water policy. Mm. So you're not going to have a balance to Dianne Feinstein there to talk about water anymore. It's a very disappointing race.
It's a shame because it's kind of an important job, as it turns out.
It's a super important job, but I don't know. Maybe Kamala will blossom. What do you think?
Loretta Sanchez had three assets at her disposal. She had Southern California, her base. Mm-hmm. She had Latinos, her base. Mm-hmm. And she had everybody to the right of Kamala Harris.
Yeah,
and there's a fair number.
Yeah.
And she has run. If she wants to write a book, the next one should be How to Blow Your Campaign.
Right.
Because she had these assets. They're wonderful assets. And she has not used them at all.
No.
Which is rather a shame. I have a bigger beef here. And that is that we have this top two system. I think it's shameful. I think it's shameful that we don't have a Republican running against a Democrat. I think it's shameful that we have all these growing numbers of districts where we have Republicans against Republicans, Democrats against Democrats. Minor parties are left out. I think we took the easy way out, you know, in trying to cultivate moderation. And frankly, it hasn't worked. I'm done.
I think it's too early to know if it's worked. I mean, you have Ro Khanna and Mike Honda. Ro Khanna is a Democrat through and through, on most things, progressive Democrat, but he is more moderate than Mike, and he's thoughtful. And I think in a Congress that could ever work across the aisle, I think Ro could probably do it. Give another decade or so and see if there's a difference. Because I don't see the old way working.
Right.
I mean, in California, a Republican winning as senator, it hasn't happened for a while.
But I said they take the easy way out because the minor party has to build its base. And to Jim Brulte's credit, he's the chair of the Republican Party. He has been doing just that. Mm-hmm. But you don't let a state get to be as blue as California, you know, over 40 years and expect it to turn around on a dime.
Right.
Brulte's doing it. And you know, 10 years from now, you're going to have these guys who are elected to school boards and city councils and county board supervisors in much higher positions in California because they will have earned their stripes and made a name for themselves. We could go on this forever. I would just say
when they do, they'll be able to compete.
Yeah.
I mean, Duff Sondheim, who is one of the people in favor of the top two, we talked about it in the spring. I love Duff. He said, you know, I'm not backing off on top two. If the Republicans can't field a candidate who can make the runoff, then, you know, that's
shame on them.
Shame on them. Yeah.
I'm going to, as they say, break the fourth wall or something like that. Do you need to head out soon, Lahi?
I've got a little bit of time.
Okay, good. We had some scheduling we're trying to fit in here. Someone is referring to, I think we call it partly the Matt Lauer issue, but also the platform that candidates will take and just run with. And they're saying basically, what if people demanded that the news media, because we have to blame the news media, force them to answer the question, cut off the mic if they don't answer it.
Yeah.
It would be fun. Do you think it's realistic?
I think The problem with on television is you've got to do it in the instant. I mean, later it came out that Trump had actually said to Matt Lauer in an interview when the war was starting that he fully supported it. There's a clip out there, you know, and if Matt had remembered that, he'd probably have said that. I don't know. But, you know, you've had from the beginning the New York Times, the Washington Post constantly doing these fact check. We have PolitiFact. You have all of these things online and in print that do the fact checking. Television has never been good at that, and it's partly because of the instantaneous nature of it. I don't know.
He's very hard to cover. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for the media because I think it's he's very hard to cover, and I think he's. I've talked to a number of reporters about this who have to cover him, and and it's just it's hard because on the one hand you want to just write today Donald Trump, who is a joke, said blah 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 blah. They can't do that, right? Because they're supposed to be reporting, and it's he's a tough guy to cover. He's just he's a unique character in our political history in that way.
I think Matt Lauer went after Hillary to a degree that he was seen as not going after Trump, and that was part of the problem. But on fact-checking, it's really hard. I'm sorry, Larry, I jumped.
No. The fact-checking's always difficult. Was it Candy?
Candy Crowley.
Candy Crowley did it. And I think everybody's eyes got real big real fast, you know? How dare you challenge? but in the veterans thing, I think the problem was the amount of time that NBC, wait a minute, NBC, it was fine.
Says our political analyst for NBC Bay Area.
I think he spent too much time on the email thing, 20 minutes out of 30 minutes. And go to the email. But I mean, what about China? What about the South, the Spratly Islands? What about Russia? What about the Middle East and Syria? I mean, there were so many foreign policy.
Yeah.
And with Trump, he bounced around. You know, and I think that was a problem.
Okay. Folks, we've reached the time for our week-to-week news quiz. We have a prize delivery person. Alan, if you're here, could you come up and get the chocolate? For any of you who have... is that here? The way we do this is I'll ask a question. Hope I'll be able to see you. If you think you know the answer, don't just shout it out. Raise your hand. Hopefully I'll be able to see you. And I'll call on you, shout it out then, and if you win, Alan gives you chocolate. It's a dream come true. Okay, so the first question. The government of Turkey has formally requested the detention and extradition of whom? I saw your hand over there in the green. That's right. Abdullah Gulen is a Turkish-born, U.S.-based cleric. Alan over there on the far end of the green. That's correct. Next question. After only 41 years, Saturday Night Live has finally added what to its cast? Or more accurately, someone who is what? And I saw, ma'am, we're there in the white.
A Latina.
That's correct. A Latina cast member, comedian, Melissa, I'm going to mispronounce this, Villasenor, I think, something like that. So raise your hand so Alan can make this whole evening worthwhile for you. Okay. This week, David Cameron resigned his role, his position, where? In what? Ma'am in the white, back there. That's right, in Parliament. He had resigned already as Prime Minister, as I'm sure you know. This was actually getting rid of his seat and going off to live on his pension, I think. Kerry Tolstead is leaving Wells Fargo with a payout of nearly $125 million. What did she do at Wells Fargo? Does anyone know? Someone who hasn't won yet. Anyone? Oh, yes, over there.
Customer service and 1.5 million fake credits.
That's right. She ran the department that created 1.5 million fake accounts for which Wells Fargo just paid $185 million in record fines.
Wow.
Well, heck of a job, Brownie. So this week we learned that political commentator Bill O'Reilly actually has one topic about which he will, quote, keep my big mouth shut, unquote. What is that? Did you see this? He made this comment on TV.
No.
Anyone raise your hand? Anyone want to guess? Okay. He, and I hope I'm not missing anyone, he refuses to comment on departed Fox News CEO Roger Ailes. What did Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin say should happen if Hillary Clinton becomes president? Right there? Sorry? Blood will be shed. There will be bad... Yes. Yes, yes. Okay, so three members of an Islamic State sleeper cell were arrested today in what country? Sir? Sorry? No. Right behind you. Sorry? That's right, in Germany. You were very close, sir. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management wants to rid itself of what? A whole bunch of whats. Who said that? Okay, you won, that won. Raise your hand first next time. Right over there. Keith, raise your hand so he can get you your chocolate. And just a couple more. The Norilsk Nickel Factory in northern Russia has finally copped responsibility for what? What did it do? Back there?
Did it turn a river red?
It turned a river red. Wow. It admitted that it had an outflow from its factory had caused that. Okay. One more. Of course, some of these questions actually were answered during the program, so. And they don't get chocolate for actually answering them. Okay. Today, Southern California did what it loves to do best. Television channels covered a high-speed highway chase involving what? Right there in the green.
A big rig.
That's right, a big rig tractor semi. That is correct. Well, listen, we'll be back with more news quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to discuss on Monday, October 17th in San Francisco. And you can find our week-to-week news quiz every week on Huffington Post. Thanks to our great panel, Dr. Larry Gersten, Dr. Lonnie Chen, and Barbara Marshman. Thanks to all of you for coming out tonight and everyone watching online. We'll see you next time.